Hey folks, want to talk a little bit about our sponsor for the coaching staff, Ruiz Auto Services and Exhaust, all American used cars and trucks. Had to bring my car in just last week, and Juan Carlos and everybody there took great care of me. They've got some great deals for you folks here, and you're going to want to listen carefully to this. If you're in the Omaha area and you need an oil change, you need to go to Ruiz Auto Services and Exhaust, 4839 North 90th Street here in Omaha. If you go there on Wednesday, it's only $15 for the labor on your oil change. You need to mention a pen and a napkin, but it's only $15 on Wednesdays for the labor for your oil changes. If you need a new set of tires, go to Ruiz Auto, and it is, if you get a set of four tires, they'll take $75 off if you mention a pen and a napkin. And finally, All American Used Cars and Trucks, 144th and I-80 there. If you say a pen and a napkin 2025, if you mention a pen and a napkin 2025, it is $300 off of any used car or truck out at All American Used Cars and Trucks. So if you are in the need of an oil change, if you are in need of a new set of tires, if you are in the need of a nice new to you automobile, you need to go check out Ruiz Auto Services and Exhaust. Again, 4839 North 90th Street here in Omaha, or All American Used Cars and Trucks, 144th and I-80 here in Omaha. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. My name is Marty Plum, and I am your host of a Pen and a Napkin podcast, a weekly coaching clinic you can carry around with you in your pocket. Welcome back to the coaching staff, episode number 131, and we are excited. It's a little doom and gloom outside, but that's okay. We're tough. We can handle it. It's the Midwest in the spring. We are used to this. We're excited to hear our partners from Ruiz Auto Services and Exhaust, our sponsorship partners here, done some terrific work for the Plums here this last week. You've just heard that advertisement. And just now, you are going to hear from my co-host, Mr. Tony D. Viss. Mr. Viss, how are you doing this fine Sunday evening?
Doing well. I've kind of had a really laid back Sunday. Got a little nap in there. I think that was important for me. But yeah, doing well. The temperature is low 70s. I don't know if it can get a whole lot better. So now, are you warning me that worse weather is on the way?
To the next couple of days here in Omaha, we'll definitely get rained on. We're kind of at the fringe of one of those storm warnings. You know, some wind, you know, a little bit of hail, you know, that type of thing. So it's just, you know how it is. It's the Midwest in the spring. And I don't mean to diminish that. I know that over the last two or three days, there's been numerous tornadoes in Missouri and Kentucky and some places, and people have lost their lives. So by no means am I tossing that aside. We're just a year removed from a massive EF4 tornado that went through our city at the fringes. We're lucky. If it was 2 miles east, it would have destroyed thousands of homes. So as I say that, folks, I'm not diminishing the threat of bad weather. I'm just saying that, you know, it's just kind of one of those deals that we got to live through, right, buddy?
Yeah. I give you a great example. We played our district singles and doubles on Wednesday, and it was 87, I think, 87, 89, something like that. Mm-hmm. And then we had team qualifying yesterday, and we played in the morning. It was like 47, 49 degrees. So that's kind of the roller coaster that this time of the year provides.
Yes, it does. So speaking of roller coasters, you know who went on a roller coaster in 1948, Tony?
Ooh, I do not.
It was the Baltimore Bullets. They were able to pull out the NBA championship series over the Philadelphia Warriors, who were aiming for the repeat. The Bullets beat them 2-1 in the finals. So, unfortunately for Mike Bixler, no repeat.
Huh. I thought Bix could pull it off, but evidently...
Bix.
Yo, Bix.
Yeah.
And Dino.
And yes.
Let's don't shortchange Dino.
Yes, exactly. So, yes, that is the 1948 NBA championship. 1947-48 college basketball season culminated. take a guess. Blue Blood won the NCAA championship in 48, Tony. You want to take a guess who it was? The Kentucky Wildcats beat the Baylor Bears 58-42. Their head coach was a gentleman by the name of Adolph Rupp.
I think I heard of him before. Seemed to be doing okay.
Yeah, other than being a blatant racist, you know, he was a heck of a basketball coach, you know.
He was a heck of a basketball coach, but yeah, he's a little racist.
Yeah. Yeah. So the first of four championships for Coach Rupp, whom will be, you know, obviously his name will come up multiple times here as we go through things. Or this might, it might have been his second. I think he might have had five. I might have miscounted on that one there. I gotta have to go back to my list.
You're not a math teacher.
Yeah, but I do teach history. I should know that stuff. So let me look that up real quick. Tony, we're here to talk about one-on-one this week. The importance of one-on-one, it was something... Oh, he did have four national championships. So that was the first of four. You know, the importance of one-on-one, as I became more seasoned and experienced as a coach, I really made sure that playing one-on-one every day in practice. Now, the kids might not have known that they were playing one-on-one in practice, but we were playing one-on-one 5 to 10 minutes every day. For me, it was all about we've got to be able to score when we don't have a quote-unquote play ran for somebody. And we've got to be able to guard people in space. We've got to be able to guard to the best of our ability without our help coming and allowing the offense to get two on the ball and then get us in the blender. And that was really my, as Michael Scott would say, epiphany, that I had. And it took a while. It took a while for me to get there, but I think probably my last 6 or 7 years, almost every single day in some way, shape, or form, we were playing one-on-one, and those were the big reasons why.
Yeah, I mean, one of those deals where you take a look at the fact that as you get to the later part of the season, like the NBA playoffs are obviously on, there's no secrets. Once you have that much film on people, and what's going to happen is it's going to come late clock and you have to have somebody who can score the ball and kind of deviate from the offense that's being run. And so, yeah, one-on-one is huge, and it's huge for a lot of reasons. Bigger than just scoring the ball, but that's probably the biggest caveat of it would be the ability to score it in isolation.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the keys to really, really good one-on-one basketball in practice? Because like you said, Tony, having those kids that can create plays out of nothing, that's the coin of the realm right there. It doesn't, you know, you can be the greatest coach in the world, but sometimes you just need to be bailed out by just a stud player. And that's what you need. So how do you develop that, Tony?
You know, I go back to when Oriema was rolling at UConn and he had Diana Taurasi. I mean, the year before that, when I think her junior year, she had Sue Bird and Swin Cash. I mean, they were loaded. And then Taurasi senior year, he had Taurasi and, you know, four decent players. Don't get me wrong. It's not like UConn, you know, wasn't going to get other capable players out there. But he basically would tell people the reason we're beating you is I have Diana Taurasi and you don't. And so when you take a look at one-on-one, some of the things that I really kind of am pretty picky about is I don't want you to dribble the air out of the ball. You know, again, trainers are important, don't get me wrong, and I'm not trying to belittle their role, but trainers that have them doing stuff that aren't even remotely close to game-like, drive me nuts.
Yep.
And, you know, I think you have to be efficient. You know, I go back, I can't remember if Clay had 50 or 60 that one time, and he dribbled the ball less than 10 times. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what you're looking at, is you want it to be efficient. And so I think there are times, you know, we check it in a variety of places. Maybe you check it on the baseline, check it on the lane, check it at the top of the key, you check it on the block, you check it on the nail, whatever, and you give them a limit on dribbles. You've got three, you've got two. You know, and just do things like that. And I think that's a big key to starting it, is where you teach them how to be efficient. Because if you sit here and you do, you know, 14 crossovers and a spin dribble and between the legs, and, you know, everybody in the gym is going to come and get you by that time.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wholeheartedly agree. The limiting of dribbles, and we, when we would limit dribbles, you know, it got to the point where they're like, okay, how many dribbles do we get? But, you know, when kids, especially young, new kids to the program, you know, I can think of a couple of kids over the years. What do you mean I can't dribble nine times? Because you're not going to dribble nine times in the middle of a game. You're just not. There's only been a couple of players that's been really effective for. Probably the most famous example of that is a guy like James Harden. And individually, that has been successful for him. But at the same time, he hasn't experienced a lot of high-level team success because of that playing style. I forget the name of the book, Tony. It's not Chris Oliver's book or Dean Oliver's book. It's a different one. And I've got it in my office at school, but I always tell my players this stat, NBA players who dribble more than twice, you want to guess what their field goal percentage is?
35.
Lower.
25.
Lower, slightly. 23. So if the best players in the world dribble more than twice, their success rate is less than 1 out of 4. And I don't care who you are, if that number doesn't grab your attention about being efficient with your dribbles and making good decisions and moving the ball, and what's the old saying, you're never as open as when you catch the ball, you know, that is that number right there just rings true to me. I don't know. I mean, I just threw that one at you there, Tony. I mean, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's about efficiency, and that's the part, you know. You go back to, you mentioned James Harden. Kobe was another one that dribbled a lot as well. You know, and you take a look at, like you said, their field goal percentage, and it's about efficiency. And you want to make sure you're getting good looks every time down the court. And the more you dribble it, especially with the shot clock, the higher stress and pressure that gets there. And so that's one of the things that I love when you mentioned the one about you're never more open when you catch the ball. I think that's a Popovich one, if I remember correctly. But yeah, I mean, you either want to shoot it, you want to move it, or you want to use your dribble to score. You don't want to use your dribble to explore.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I like that. Look at you, history teacher. You know,
didn't even know it.
Yes, gosh, that's some rhyming action right there, buddy. I love it. I love it. I didn't know I was sharing a podcast with Robert Frost. This is amazing.
You might be overreacting a little bit.
Youth sports today has become a billion-dollar industry nationwide, and grassroots basketball has been at the epicenter of this explosion. These days, players, parents, and handlers chase the almighty scholarship, NIL deals, and branding creation. However, there is still one place where basketball coaches and players come to develop their games without the fanfare and adulation of recruiting gurus, next-level evaluations, and social media highlight reels. It's not a basketball camp, it's a basketball school. Snow Valley Basketball School started as the brainchild of Herb Livesey, who, as a young adult, was inspired by the great Bob Cousy to start his own basketball camp. Starting in 1961 at Snow Valley Ski Resort, east of Los Angeles, before moving to Westmont College in Santa Barbara, Livesey's school was a place for the game's greatest coaches to teach the game throughout the 1970s and 80s. Two Iowans, Don Showalter and Jerry Slykus, adopted Livesey's curriculum, bringing the school to Wartburg College in Waverly, Iowa in 1994. This summer will be a celebration of its 30th anniversary of Snow Valley in the Hawkeye State. Here, over 1,400 campers will start each day before dawn and end after the sun goes down. Snow Valley Basketball School is America's longest continuously running basketball camp. It's where players come to learn and coaches come to teach. For those that come there every summer, it is the home to the last of the Cowboys. The Last of the Cowboys, the story of Snow Valley Basketball School, will be available on Amazon on July 1st, 2025. Paperback copies will be available for $17.99, while Kindle copies will be available for pre-order for $9.99. Get to know the story of America's longest continuous basketball camp. Tony, let's dive into some of our, one of the things we're going to do here for folks is we're going to talk about some of our favorite one-on-one drills. And I was, I got about one, two, three, four, five, about seven or eight-ish altogether that you can do. I'll let you start, Tony. Let's chop it out here. What do we got?
I'm going to start very, very simple. And this is how we build our defense. It's zigzags, you know, and we do a variety of things out of zigzags. Like for the first round, we make the offense go about 70%, and they take them boundary line to boundary line. And then the next time we jack it up a little bit where they're going 100%, but if they get by you, they're going to dribble in to create contact, and they're going to pull that dribble, let you recover, and then try to beat you again. And then we'll do another round of it. We'll dribble up just about half court, just on our side of half court, pick it up. We have them mirror it, count to four. And then at four, they retreat step. And then at five, the offense has their dribble back and it's live one-on-one to the rim. And if the offense scores, the defense has some type of calisthenic. But that's where I'll start. That's one of my favorite ones. That's just where we start building our defense from. And I really like that series a lot.
Mm-hmm. I have... we really start ours in the quarter court with what we just call chop drill. And what we do is we just have a player on the wing, player on the block, on the ball side block, and they roll it out. Now, whatever you are, if you're a force middle team, defense has to force it middle. If you're playing straight up, you know, pure Jim Boone pack line, play it straight up. For us, we were a push baseline team. So if they got to the middle, they automatically lost, whether or not they scored or not, you know. But we just roll it out. Defense closes out. Good stance, get low, high hands. And we're playing one-on-one. Two or three dribbles. Sometimes we just play to one shot if we want to emphasize rebounding. Hey, you can go get the offensive rebound. We don't, and I don't know if this makes sense, but we don't really allow, in our one-on-one drills, I was never a big guy like, okay, just go play, go get the ball. We limit it to one shot a lot of the time, because for me, my thought process was, I don't know what the exact percentage is, but I would say 80 to 90% of the time, the rebound goes to somebody who's not guarding the shooter. So we're not really worried about that particular box out. And I didn't want to, I wanted to force the offense to concentrate on trying to score instead of, I'm just going to go ahead and miss, but I'm going to get a better shot by just getting offensive rebound, the old Moses Malone type of thing. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of what we did on a lot of ours, is we didn't really worry about the defensive box out. We were more worried about the offside defensive box out, and that's where we got into stuff in other different drills there. So I don't know. Is that a bad idea? Is that a good idea, Tony? What do you think?
I think it's good. I don't know if I would do it every single time I did that drill. Mm-hmm. Because I think one of the things that sometimes we maybe don't evaluate enough is that when the shooter shoots it, more times than not, they're the one who knows if it's a miss or a make, and they know where they missed it at and where the ball's most likely to go. But yeah, we run some type of version of that, but we'll do it where it's like a line of them. And you get one shot, and if you get a stop, you're in great shape. And if you get scored on, it's kind of a make it, take it type deal. And so we'll do stuff like that. But yeah, I like that drill a lot.
Okay. What's another one you got, buddy?
You know, another one that we do that's similar to that, and we both have talked before about the danger of just working on one thing in a drill, that you always want multiple things in a drill. And so what we usually will do is, like, I'll have the ball as the coach on the weak side of the floor. We got a player in help. I'll throw the skip pass. And then they've got to close out. And then, like you mentioned, you know, depending upon which way you force, and we're like you, we force it baseline. You have to force that way. And like you said, if they get beat middle, it's done already. And it doesn't matter if they make the shot or not. And then we play it live one-on-one. And more times than not, and I probably erred too much on this one, but more times than not, we make it where if they miss, we play it out. You got to block out. You got to rebound. If you don't block out and rebound, we let them, we give them their dribbles back. So if you rebound it, you got two or three more dribbles, depending upon how many dribbles we happen to be giving them that day.
That's one of the ones I had written down. I think we called it like weak side one-on-one or something akin to that, where, yeah, you throw the skip pass and your defender's got to go close out. Like I said, you know, like you talk, you know, high hands, that type of thing, close out to the ball. It's great to force them to come at it from a different angle. They're coming from the gap and they're going after it there. So you stole one of mine, Tony. Hey, no, it's fine. It's okay. I'm just thrilled that I'm on here with Judy Blume, you know, great.
Ramona.
Am I Beezus now?
Yeah.
Kind of in that same vein, one of the ones that I didn't do this one very often, should have done it more. Defender underneath the basket. And I don't know. I just call this one on two. Defender underneath the basket. A player on each wing, offensive player on each wing. Coach is underneath the basket. And the coach is just going to roll it out or kick it out to one of those two. You know, the defense doesn't know which player they're going to go to. And they've got to close out and they're going one on one. And you could get a lot of reps in really, really quickly there. You can do a deal where offense scores, they stay, defense has to stay, or defense has to go until they get X amount of closeouts in a row. I mean, there's little challenges that you could put in there. Now, again, you don't want the worst player on your JV to be stuck in a drill with your top seven varsity kids, and they're all they're doing is playing defense for 7 minutes straight, and that does nobody any good. So you have to be kind of careful with that. But that's, you know, those, that's another thing that you can do in that regard. But one on two, just really, really simple, closing out, having to react. You know, you can do the foot fire thing if you want to before they throw it out. There's a lot of different ways that you can do that, but that's another really simple one on one drill.
As you were saying that, it reminded me of a rebounding drill that we do that's kind of similar to that. We put the players at each elbow, player with their butt to the baseline, coach on the baseline with a ball, and the coach is going to whip the ball to one of the two players at the elbow. They've got to close out. We want them to shoot to make it, but we tell them that no matter what, the shot is being played as a miss, and then we just turn into a one-on-one rebounding drill. And so that one's usually pretty good for us. Then we just have, you know, four or five at a hoop. The gal or guy who was on defense had to close out. We'll go up to the elbow. Other one slides across the other elbow. Rotate a fresh player in. So you get four or five kids. You can get a lot of reps in that in a short amount of time.
You want to do another one?
Yeah, another one that we'll do too is we'll put players in the five spots around the court, both wings, top of the key. And so the player will start on the baseline or the hoop with the ball. They'll roll the ball out to whichever one. You're going to play live one-on-one, and then they're going to get one shot. The defensive player is going to get it, roll the ball to the next spot, close out, play again. So you're playing one-on-one, five straight possessions, and we'll have like a certain number of stops you must get. Otherwise, you have some type of calisthenic. And so we'll do things like that. They're usually pretty effective that way as well, just to add to the competitiveness of it. So that's not just you kind of go through the motions. No, you got to get a certain number of stops, you know, whether that's three, four, whatever the case may be. And then you have an extra player or two down there, you kind of rotate them through, but you're really working on conditioning with it as well as you're trying to, as you were having to get those five consecutive possessions in on defense.
Our mutual friend, Jamie Smith from Solon High School.
Oh,
yes. I directly stole two or three great one-on-one drills from him. So One is offensive player's got the ball on the wing. Defensive player is standing right next to them, and the defensive player has the hand on the shoulder, the inside shoulder of the offensive player. So offensive player is closer to the baseline sideline. Defensive player has inside position. Defensive player has their hand on the offensive player. As soon as the offensive player starts to dribble, obviously the defender's got to try and defend that. And they've got to recover. They've got to try and beat him to the spot. Offensive player has to go up and try to finish a challenge shot here. Just really, really simple. In that same vein, same setup, but this time the defender is standing at the free throw line extended. The offensive player is standing behind them, and they've got the basketball in the small of their back. And as soon as the offensive player is ready to go, they take it. And as soon as they take the ball off the defender's back, it's live. And now they're trying to go and score, and they're playing one-on-one there. So those are two, you know, you can just boom, 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 boom. You can get a ton of reps in a short amount of time with a bunch of different kids by doing things in that way. And so you're either a replicator or an innovator. And in that situation, I replicated exactly what Jamie was doing there. And I thought those are two really good drills that are related to each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those sounded good. We do one we call the Curry drill.
Okay.
We'll put two lines in the baseline, garbage can, chair, whatever, out on the wing. And you can move them around. This is where we started at. And the offensive player will go, and they have to dribble the ball. They can either go outside in, inside out, doesn't matter to us, mm-hmm. but they have to go around the chair, around the garbage can, while the defensive player has to sprint around it as well. Mm-hmm. And then you have a contested finishing drill at the rim. And we talk to our players because we don't want anybody to get hurt. We talk to them about different strategies and stuff to work on with that. But yeah, that's one that we do quite a bit, the Curry drill. And then we'll take and put a middle line, and the middle line has to touch either the free throw, top of the key, depending. And now it turns into a 2-on-1. And I know we're talking one-on-one drill, yeah. But just something else that we'll do out of it that is a good little addition as well.
You took one of mine there, Tony. I saw it as somebody called it Spanish one-on-one, because I'm assuming they took it from the Spanish national team. Same exact drill. I literally had that written down. So, and I like that one too. Do you move the defender's cone or chair in a little bit to kind of try and give them a little bit of a positioning advantage, so the offensive player has to, go through somebody a little bit more, or do you just keep it pretty equal on both sides?
For the most part, beginning of the year, we'll keep it pretty equal, because one of the things that I've noticed with missed layups and such is whether they're getting chased from behind or whether they're even or whatever the case may be, they got their eyes on the defender and they're not focused on finishing. And we use it more as a finishing drill. But as the year goes on, I'll cheat so that they have to do, you know, whether it's a slow step or whether it's a shot fake or whatever it might be, so that they have to add something to it in order to score once the defender gets their hips in front of them.
Gotcha. Cool. All right. Another one I got, and I forget where I got this. I think it was the Snow Valley one, but I just call it USA one-on-one. Maybe I got it from USA Gold Camp. I don't know. Anyway, and you can do this from a couple of different angles, different spots. Like the kind of the easiest one is two players are on the block and the coach is in the middle of the lane and they've just got a ball. And whoever they throw the ball to, they've got to take it, go up and score. If you don't get the ball, you got to go wall up and defend. That, or you can take that same concept. A coach is standing on the nail. Two players are at the elbows and you just go doink and you just drop it off to one or the other. Whoever doesn't get it, they've got to go in and cut them off. Or instead of putting them at the elbows, you could take them and put them at the free throw line extended. And whoever you throw it to, obviously the other one's got to sprint and get there and beat them to the spot and try to take a charge or whatever it may, try to get a stop. You know, so USA one-on-one is what I've called those, Tony. And it's, it's you can vary it up. You can do it if you really feel like you got to work on finishing around the basket, putting layups back up and in, move it to the blocks. If you want to put bring it away from the basket, work on dribble drive, that's a great spot to do that in as well. So USA 101, that's another one I got.
Yeah, we like post 101 is one that we'll do as well, where you get a player with their back to the basket, where we usually have them post up on the first marker, spin the ball out. They've got to hop, get it, chin it, and then they have to read the defender and make a one-on-one move and score in the post. And this is one that we like because, you know, I know that part of the game is maybe not what it used to be, the emphasis on it. But the last time I checked, you still shoot a little bit higher percentage closer to the basket. You do from behind the arc or from mid-range or whatever the case may be. But that's one on occasion, too, that we like to work on with our guards so that we can find if they're good post-up kids, you can always invert your offense a little bit as well. But we will limit that to either one dribble or no dribble so mm-hmm. that another one where you're not trying to dribble the air out of them.
Gotcha. I have two left, Tony. They're pretty close to each other, kind of like the USA ones. What say you? What do you got left?
I got one.
Okay, go ahead, and then I'll wrap it up.
Yeah, the one that we do, this is kind of similar to what I was talking about earlier with the Curry drill a little bit, but we make this more of a full court thing. We call them chaser layups, and we'll do them from a couple different spots, but we'll start off at the elbow, put a mm-hmm. player on the baseline, and then eventually we'll move that player from the baseline up to the block. And then the other thing that we'll do from time to time is we'll move the offensive player out to the hash on the sideline and let the player start at the elbow. And then it's basically where you're having a dribble quickly down the court while you are being pursued and trying to make sure that you finish a layup that's contested. And again, we'll mm-hmm. talk about, you know, stripping them as they bring it up, tipping it from behind.
Yep.
We don't want to put anybody into the wall or anything like that. But it also teaches players that maybe aren't the fleetest of foot, some of those slow play things, some of those footwork things, some of those shot fake jump stop, things to work on as well. And so that's one that we've grown to like quite a bit also.
Yeah. Kind of like the new thing is for players to actually slow down and almost come to a complete stop and then step, finish type of a thing. Is that kind of a something you're emphasizing there, buddy?
Yes. We you know, you see that all the time. Whatever it may be, Euro steps or whatever. And then we usually call our pivot series that we'll do out of it as well, Iowa State pivot. So we'll jump stop, shot fake, pivot, and then take the shot that way. But just trying to teach them a little bit of craftiness around the hoop. But yeah, that Jalen Brunson, those guards that do a really good job of getting in front, creating contact, and then going into them to create space and get that shot off.
Mm-hmm. When you were playing, you just went up and flushed it like Dr. J in game six, right?
I think the only thing I ever flushed was the toilet, Marty.
Okay. That was a good one.
Every once in a while, I stumble on them.
Jenny and I were watching Celtic City this afternoon, and it was the Celtics from basically when Larry Bird got there until Bill Fitch got fired. And so there was quite a few Dr. J highlights. I was regaling my daughter in, everybody wanted to be Dr. J back in 1982, 1983, you know, type of a thing. So, the two other ones that I have, and these are Don Meyer staples, jail and brick wall. And so what we would do is for jail, we would have the offensive player go behind the basket, basically kind of a little bit outside, not in the short corner, but not stuck behind the backboard, you know. The defensive player would have inside position, and with our high school kids, you had one dribble to get out of jail and score. We're not going to let you get out of there easily. You've got to get down. You've got to get big, stay vertical, that type of a thing. Guards, like you were talking about, you know, with your post up one, guards mm-hmm. and post players are all doing this. We're working on finishing. And then brick wall is basically that same concept, but we would move it out. Now you're on the second stripe. You're in between the three stripes there. You put the ball down on the floor right on the stripe there. Excuse me. You pick it up and you've got one dribble to score from about 10 feet away from the basket. Again, you know, there's going to, as we both know, there's going to be a lot of traffic, a lot of contact in that area. You don't have nine dribbles down there. You got to take it. You got to be really efficient. Okay, here, my opponent is playing me this way. Boom, boom. I'm going to pivot here, go up and try to finish it. So jail and brick wall, those are the last two that I have.
I like those.
Mm-hmm. Folks, we had a great day on April the 12th at the 5th annual A Pen and a Napkin Coaches Clinic. And if you couldn't be there, that stinks. But what's fortunate for you is we taped everything that we did. So if you are interested in ordering any of our clinic videos or all of our clinic videos from our great presenters on April the 12th, it's there for you. All you have to do is DM me on Twitter at a pen and a napkin. Email me apenandanapkin@gmail.com. We've got Andy King talking about 5-on-5 transition and controlled scrimmages. Jody Steyer from Iowa State University on player development. We've got Lucas Dollinghouse on coaching through an administrator's eyes. Wade Coulter talking about pressure defense and extending your pressure defense. Raz Vanderloo with a basketball smorgasbord of stuff from Sioux City East High School. USA Basketball, and Jamie Smith from Solon High School talking about shooting and shooting technique, shooting fundamentals. It's a great lineup, great coaches, great presentations. They're there for you. $10 a piece is all the videos cost. If you want to get all six of them, I'll bundle it together for you. $50 for all six videos. So coaches, if you weren't there, too bad, but because we're thinking ahead here, we've got the videos available for you. Give me a shout out. Let me know if you want to order any or all of the 5th annual Pen and a Napkin Spring Clinic Coaches Presentations. Well, Tony, you know who I'd be willing to run through a brick wall to see live?
Europe.
We were talking about going to see Foreigner, Tony. I didn't realize how many good songs Foreigner has. And Lou Graham is going to be back out on tour with them. So
he might be in Cedar Rapids this summer.
Yeah, well, they're coming to Omaha. Council Bluffs, I should say. Okay. Concert Cove. So $75 a ticket, though. It's just in that in-between. Like if it was $50, I'd be like, yep, let's go. Even if it's not very good, it'll still be good. But it's not like 125. You're like, no, that's way too much. You know, 75, right? And it's like they know what they're doing, Tony. It's like they know what they're doing.
They've done their research.
Yeah. They act like they've been touring for 50 years. What's their issue? So this week's trivia question, Tony, we are nearing the NBA finals. Trivia question for you. Which franchise has the longest current drought in the NBA of not reaching the NBA Finals?
I'm going to go with the Knicks.
The Knicks is incorrect. They went to the finals in 99. Remember when Van Gundy was holding on to...
Yeah.
So
maybe it's been 50-some years since they've won it.
Yes.
That's what I saw.
Yeah, they won it. They won it the year I was born, 73.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. Well, shoot. I thought I had that one.
No, that's okay.
No, I got to go to plan B. Let's go with... Shoot. Give me a second here. We'll come up with a good guess. 76ers.
That is incorrect. I think the last time that Iverson, 2001.
Wow, we stepped over Ty Lue.
Yes, yes. You're actually getting worse at this.
Damn. Yeah. You would think I would be getting better.
You have one guess left.
Let's go Clippers.
Although that would be a great answer because they've never been to the finals, they have not had the longest drought. Would you like to know the answer, my friend?
I would, because I have no clue.
It is the Rochester Royals, who became the Cincinnati Royals, who became the Kansas City Omaha Kings, who became the Kansas City Kings, who are now the Sacramento Kings. The last 74 years, Tony, since the Kings have made the NBA Finals, the 1950-51 season.
Wow.
Yeah.
I wasn't even close. Well, yeah. I kind of was. It was in the same state.
Yeah, it was in the same state, yes. Second longest, the Atlanta Hawks, 64 years. Okay. Yeah. And then the Washington Wizards are third with 46 years. Other than
I don't see any of those teams ever making it within any time soon.
I think that streak is going to continue to extend itself for quite a while. But if they did make the finals, I think Mel Allen would say, that's a good transition, Tony.
It was really good.
Yeah, yeah.
I like you've done this a time or two.
Yeah, you know, it, like you said, every once in a while, it's not getting something right here. So let's start in the NBA, Tony. Let's game six, Friday night, the Boston Massacre in New York, the boy, just ugly. But I think, if you really thought about it, it shouldn't be that surprising that New York beat them that badly, because New York hadn't really played well yet, and they've got enough talented guys that they're going to play well eventually. And Boston just ran out of gas. Just as a team, collectively, just ran out of gas.
Yeah, I mean, you take a look at all the things that Boston, you know, obviously had to overcome. You find out later on about Brown and the meniscus, Tatum obviously with the Achilles, and then you go and take a look at Porzingis' mysterious thing that he's got going on. That's three of your starters. And I don't know how many teams could handle that, but if you go back, you know, they led three of the four losses by double digits.
Yep.
And only to lose those games. That was tough. And so a situation where, I'm trying to remember who they were talking to today about, you know, they blow the Celtics up, and they're like, you know, the Spurs never won back-to-back, but they won five.
Yeah.
And, you know, you get the Celtics healthy, they're still a big threat.
Yeah. I agree with you. I think I don't see them blowing it up. I think they're going to make changes. I think they're going to have to make changes. You know, Sam Hauser is probably gone. I would think they might have to sell Drew Holiday's contract 50 cents on the dollar, maybe. I think they're going to try and keep Porzingis. I would not be surprised to see Al Horford retire. So I think they're going to loosen up some money through some different ways. You know, we'll see what happens with Jaylen Brown. I mean, they might just do what the Warriors did, where they might just completely punt and say, let's win 20 games next year. Tatum's out. We're going to have Jaylen Brown completely rehab this meniscus tear. And there is a great draft class coming in next year. Maybe that's the route that the Celtics end up taking. You know, we'll see.
Yeah, I mean, and they still have some good pieces. If Tatum, you know, misses the entire year, they still have some good pieces. I don't see them trying to blow it up, but they'll be an interesting watch. They'll be one of the more intriguing teams to watch this summer.
Yes. Game seven today in the Western Conference wasn't much of a game. As Ron Burgundy would say, it escalated quickly. I'm cruising along. I'm watching the game. It's pretty close, about halfway through the second quarter. Carla and the two boys got back from the grocery store. Let's unload all the groceries. So we do that for a few minutes. I come back downstairs. Halftime has just started, and the Nuggets are down 14. And I'm like, oh, man, that escalated quickly. And then the Thunder came out on like a 10-2, 12-2 run to start the second half. And it was pretty much a bludgeoning after that point. And so, I think Oklahoma City was the much better team. Very similar to Boston. I think Denver just gave out. Aaron Gordon hurt. Michael Porter Jr. hurt. Jokic playing 1,000 minutes a game. You know, I just think that it's, I think they too just kind of ran out of gas. And then you have, of course, all the behind the scenes drama as well.
Yeah, they're a team that, very limited team. I think anybody that thought that they were going to upset Oklahoma City maybe didn't observe all the stuff there. And Oklahoma City is the one seed, has the best record in the NBA. They're the deeper team. I mean, to get to game seven is truly an impressive work by the Nuggets. And then, like you said, Michael Porter Jr. came in and was compromised with his health issues. You take a look at Jamal Murray was sick in game six, still played, had a really good game.
Yep.
And then, you know, I give Aaron Gordon a huge amount of credit for even trying to play. I mean, I'm not calling Steph Curry soft. I'm sorry. But one of those things where he didn't get out there, Aaron Gordon kept playing, and granted, very compromised in his play, but kept competing. And then, like you said, Denver got off to a pretty good start. I'm like, oh, this could be an interesting game. And then right before halftime, the wheels kind of came off. You could see that they were just playing out of gas. And they took Jokic out for a quick break, and I think it was like a 12-14 nothing run in 2 minutes, and just insane.
Yeah. I will say that on the street, Alex Caruso committed 6 to 9 misdemeanors on Jokic guarding him off the ball here today. And I get it. He's bad. He's 6'5 against a 7-foot dude that outweighs him by 60 pounds and that type of thing. But I'm all for physical basketball. And maybe this is a little bit of my Nuggets homer coming out in me, but you can't just tackle the guy every single play. You know, that's just me, Tony. That's just me.
No, I'll be honest, Marty. I mean, they'll say a variety of things about, hey, we want freedom of movement, want to clean the game up. And I think the mentality is just at times, you know, we're going to foul them every time. They're going to call it every time. They might call, you know, less and less as the regular season, and definitely less and less as you go into the playoffs. But yeah, it's frustrating because sometimes it doesn't resemble basketball.
Correct. Absolutely. So, who you got in the, we've got Oklahoma City and Minnesota. We've got New York and Indiana. Who do you think is going to be in the finals, buddy?
You know, the interesting thing is I think both series are going to be very, very competitive. I mean, you take a look at it. I think New York is the 3, Indiana's the 4. And, you know, Indiana's on a roll, playing really, really well. You know, came in and took down the number one seed in the East was Cleveland, but Cleveland had some issues. You know, it's hard to play as many games as these guys play and be in great health by the end of the year.
Yeah.
And you've seen that with numerous players with some of these very, very serious injuries and things like that. But I am going to take New York for whatever reason. I just think they're going to do it. I think they're a little bit better defensively than what the Pacers are. The Pacers are the better team offensively. But I think what you saw with New York was getting past that Boston, Cleveland, Oklahoma City hurdle with taking down the Celtics. And so I'm going to take New York in the East, and then the West. Man, there's a part of me that says, you know, to take Minnesota, but I am going to go with Oklahoma City. I think they're the one seed for a reason. But I'm going to take Oklahoma City. I think the home court advantage is going to play out for them. But there's a part of me that last year when Minnesota was the one who took down Denver, Minnesota didn't have any gas in the tank to go against Dallas and got beat. Mm-hmm. And I kind of wonder if this is going to be the same thing that's going to happen here with the Thunder.
Yeah. I think it's going to be David Stern's worst nightmare. It's going to be Indiana and Oklahoma City. And I think both series are going to be very competitive. I think Indiana's playing really, really well right now. I think, you know, Tyrese Halliburton is playing great, and they're Indiana's better than they were last year, and they beat New York last year. And I know New York was beat up some last year, and I get that. But I think Indiana's even better than they were last year. I like them in 6. And then I think Oklahoma City's going to win in 6 or 7 against Minnesota. I think it's going to be a long series. I think both series are going to be really, really good series. But that would be, if David Stern were involved... I can see Indiana kind of struggling a bit here at times with a couple of questionable calls, but I think that's my opinion. We'll see. I think both of them are going to be really, really competitive. Really quick, Tony, your reaction to the Cooper Flag sweepstakes. I believe I said two of the teams that I didn't want to get it were Dallas and Philadelphia, and lo and behold, they finish 1-3 in the lottery, and Charlotte, Utah, and Washington end up 4, 5, 6. It's a lottery for a reason. You get lucky for a reason, but yuck.
And it makes you wonder, from the standpoint of Dallas obviously sold low on Luka, and then they get the number one pick. And you go back and you take a look at Patrick Ewing going to New York, LeBron going to Cleveland, and some of the things that have happened, you're just like, huh, that's a lot of coinkydinks. But yeah, I don't know. It'll be interesting. I feel bad because I think it's been either the last 3 or 4 years, the team with the worst record in the NBA has gotten the 5th pick, if I remember correctly.
Wow.
I think it's been the last 3 years the worst record has gotten the 5th pick. And you feel for those franchises a little bit. And they're in the place they are because of some of the other stuff they've done. But it's like, man, you kind of hope that at some point in time, those fan bases get hope. But Unfortunately, it seems like it was taken from them once again.
Well, they're paying for the crimes of the Sam Presti, you know, process Sixers, you know, Utah, Charlotte, Washington. You know, Presti abused the system so badly that they had to change it. And these teams were tanking. There's no doubt about that. But they're being punished for somebody else's sins, in my opinion, Tony. I mean, that's and I get it. You want to make the lottery exciting. You don't want teams to, again, if the Hinkie process Sixers weren't going to abuse the privilege, somebody else was going to along the lines at some point. They were going to do the same thing. He was just the first one to do it, and then they changed the system because of it. But I think that's the crime in it, in my opinion. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, it's unfortunate, but like you said, I can see both sides of the argument, but it does seem like those teams who are maybe not taking advantage of the system like what was done with the Sixers are the ones that are reaping the consequences.
Mm-hmm. Coaches are absolutely loving our Taking Over a New Program booklet. As many of you know, I spent 2 years outside of coaching, and during that time, I hung a note card in my workspace at school that said, "Strip the house down to the studs." I took that time to really rethink and reorganize my thoughts on what it takes to run a transformational program. As I prepared for the possibility of coaching again, I organized these thoughts into this 96-page booklet. How much do I trust this booklet? I used this booklet as I went on interviews to help sell myself and my vision for what my new program would look like. If I'm using it to sell myself, why wouldn't I recommend it to you, my listeners? This booklet will help you look at any part of your program, no matter what stage you're at in your program, and help improve it in some way. It's all yours for only $15, which includes shipping and handling. For more information, email me at apenandanapkin@gmail.com. Want to know more about A Pen and a Napkin and all the resources it offers? Go to apenandanapkin.com, a great resource for any coach at any level. In addition to our A Pen and a Napkin University video library options that are available to order, we have hundreds of pages of notes, from one-page handouts to book breakdowns to original coaching notes. We also have coaching links, a full catalog of every A Pen and a Napkin podcast, and ways to contribute to the growth of A Pen and a Napkin. apenandanapkin.com is a coaching resource that will help you become a better coach. We are back to our newest segment here, Two Plums and a Dingleberry. And my wonderful, beautiful, recent college graduate son, Carter Plum, is here with us. Carter, how you doing, buddy?
I'm good.
Good. Good. How was your dad's hamburgers tonight?
They're pretty good.
Yeah. See? Not so bad. Not so bad. So we're going to talk a little WNBA. We obviously had the season debut. I actually went over to Carter's apartment on Friday night. We watched a little ball together on Friday evening. You know, first of all, you know, obviously kind of the big headline coming out of the first weekend here is another confrontation here between Angel Reese and Caitlin Clark. Caitlin got the best of the matchup, that's for sure, on the floor. The Fever rolled the Chicago Sky. It was a 93-58, some crazy number like
they won
that.
They won by
quite a bit. So, but then what everybody is focusing on, not Caitlin Clark's triple-double or anything like that, is, of course, the very hard foul. I didn't see anything terribly malicious about it. I don't know why they upgraded it to a flagrant one, but that's just me. That's just a good foul where I'm not going to let you get a layup. Tony, your thoughts on kind of the first dust up of the season. Is this good for it or not so good?
It definitely keeps, you know, eyes and ears and all that stuff to it. It's getting ridiculous, you know, from the standpoint of, you know, the stuff that goes on there for the clicks and different things like that. It takes away from the product that's on the floor a little bit, as those two obviously have their issues there. Both are very, very talented basketball players. But unlike you, if the refs do their job and call Angel Reese for the two-hand push in the back, I think it was Natasha Howard, if I remember correctly.
Yep.
That doesn't happen. But that's the elephant in the room that nobody wants to address, is the lack of quality of WNBA officiating.
Yeah, you were on that. You've been on that for the last year, buddy. Just the lack of good officials in the W. You know, it's definitely at best up and down. Is that a generous way to say it?
That's fair.
Yeah, Carter, what do you think?
I love it. I eat it up. I think, especially because I'm a basketball fan, I'm going to watch it regardless. For other people that don't watch basketball, you got to put on a show for them to get them to keep watching. And there's nothing people love more than to cheer against somebody, and both sides cheer against the other.
Mm-hmm.
So then it gets more views. And the more people that watch the game is going to give more... I mean, they're more likely to watch it again if they watch one game. Mm-hmm. So if they see it on TikTok or Instagram, next time they play, more people are going to watch it.
Mm-hmm.
That's really all I care about. And it makes it interesting.
Yeah. What do you think, Tony?
It does get the clicks, but is it getting the clicks for the right reasons? That would be the part. I mean, it's not necessarily the product. It's more the sideshow. And I don't think that's going to get you the type of viewers for the long haul that you want.
Yeah.
That would be my two cents.
It kind of reminded me of, while Carter was saying that, Gina Davis in A League of Their Own, Tony, where she could have caught the foul ball easily, but she does the splits and then catches it, you know, and gets the pick mm-hmm. of the bacon, you know, kind of that. And I'm not comparing one to the, you know, it's I don't know if it's a good comparison or not. Let me be very clear, but you know, hopefully, you know, you just want to get eyeballs. And I don't think Caitlin Clark was like, let's get more people watching this game. I'm going to foul Angel Reese really hard here. I don't think she had enough time to. Obviously, she wasn't processing that. I think it was just, I don't want her to get a layup. I'm going to foul her hard. I think that's what she was thinking of that right there. So let's get into our previews here. WNBA West preview. Tony, you opened last week. I'm going to let Carter open this week. Who do you have seventh in the Western Conference, even though there's no such thing as conferences? They all are lined up, but we're still going to call it conferences. Yes.
I have the Golden State Valkyries.
Okay. What, Tony?
Ditto. I look at what they've done in terms of things, and it's been kind of a weird how they put it together. And I'm not saying they're tanking on purpose, but it just, I don't know. It doesn't seem like they put the pieces in that I thought that they might go out and get in the expansion draft.
Mm-hmm. I think they're a pretty convincing seventh, just like any expansion team. When the Minnesota Timberwolves expanded, or the Florida Marlins or Miami, you know, they were Florida Marlins. I remember, Tony, your season and experience enough to remember Charlie Huff throwing knuckleballs on opening day for the Marlins back in the early 90s. So they're going to be bad. They're going to be really bad. I think they're going to have a hard time winning more than 10 games. I think they're going to be that bad. So in my opinion, yeah. So, Tony, who do you have? I tell you what, I had a hard time 3 through 6 here trying to line it up here. Who did you have in sixth, Tony?
That was the challenging part, was 3 through 6. I think these teams are all very, very interchangeable. The team I would put at 6, I'm going to go with the Phoenix Mercury. They had a lot of change. Obviously, Griner's no longer there. Diana Taurasi's no longer there. They've had a lot of change. And so because of that change, I think this coach is his second year. I'm going to put Phoenix in spot 6 because of the amount of change they've had.
Carter?
I put the Seattle Storm.
Okay. Wow. We are in 3 different directions. Why'd you put Seattle?
Put Seattle because I think losing Jewel Lloyd is a very big loss for them.
Uh-huh.
Because she had a majority of their points, or was at least their leading scorer. And I think they do have Skylar Diggins-Smith, but based on her past experiences, she's had problems with team chemistry. And then at the same time, Katie Lou Samuelson tearing her ACL.
That's a big deal.
It's another big loss for them. And so outside of that, they don't really have much to produce for them besides role players. I mean, they have Neko Gumake, but besides her, there's not really much.
Hard to find offense.
Yeah.
Okay. I had the LA Sparks in 6th place. Now, I think Kelsey Plum is going to have a really big year. I think she is back into the situation more closely associated with the role that she had in Washington, which is the James Harden, Luka Doncic, a little bit more heliocentric role there. So, but I don't think they quite have enough around her yet. I think they're moving in the right direction. I think it will help when Cameron Brink gets back, but yet she's still going to be coming back from her ACL. Let's do this, because I think if we're that far off here. Tony, who did you have 6, 5, 4, 3?
6 was Phoenix, and then I agree with Carter on what's going on with Seattle. I think there's an issue there. Part of why Jewel Lloyd and some of the others wanted out was they were talking about treatment of the players. And as he mentioned with Skylar, Skylar's had some issues with chemistry and stuff. So I don't even know if Skylar will finish the year in Seattle. But I had Seattle at 5. So I had Phoenix 6, Seattle 5, and you wanted 4 as well.
4 and 3, because I think we're probably going to be pretty close on 2 and 1 here.
Okay. 4, I had the Dallas Wings at 4. And then 3, I had the LA Sparks.
So I had LA at 6 and you had them at 3. So that's interesting. So, Carter, what did you have? 6 to 3.
I had the Storm at 6. 5 was the Sparks. 4 was the Wings, and then 3 was the Mercury.
Okay, I'm just writing this all down here. And then you had the Mercury at 3?
Yeah.
So I had LA at 6, Dallas at 5, Seattle at 4, and Phoenix at 3. So, I mean, we're all over the place. You guys both had Dallas at 4. I had them at 5. Carter had Seattle at 6. Tony, you had him at 5. I had him at 4. Carter and I had Phoenix at 3. You had the LA Sparks at 3. So, I mean, it's a jumbled mess there. And I think that's probably going to be the way that's going to play out.
I would agree. I think Plum had 37 in her first game. I don't know if that obviously is sustainable throughout the season, but at some point in time, they're going to get Cameron Brink back. And De'Arik Hambry is a nice player for him as well. Rekia Jackson. But I think LA will be okay. But at the same time, I could see scenarios where they're not. And, you know, Phoenix seemed like there was an injury, and I might be wrong on that. But I just thought with losing 2 cornerstones like Taurasi and Griner, there'd be some issues there. But at the same time, they did do pretty well in free agency. And brought in some nice players out of free agency as well.
Tony, of course, Kelsey Plum can keep it up at 37 points a game. Take a look at her last name. Of course she can.
Yeah. Yes.
3 Plum.
Yes. Yeah, so.
Dingleberry's gone, though.
But the Dingleberry is gone. So let's take a look at the second spot here. Tony, what'd you have for number two?
Las Vegas Aces. I put them at two.
Carter?
I also had the Las Vegas Aces.
I had Minnesota at two. Talk to me, Goose. What do you got?
I go back and I take a look, like, and again, I get the Aces are kind of connected right now with playing the Liberty all the time, but the Liberty have really had their number quite often. And I just feel like Minnesota is on the upswing. I don't know if I would necessarily say they're the favorite to win the title, but they are one of the favorites to win the title. And so I go back through losing Kelsey Plum, I think is a big deal. Don't get me wrong, Jewel Lloyd is a really, really nice player. But I feel like the Aces, besides losing Plum, have been compromised with losing some of those bench pieces.
Yeah.
And I don't feel their bench is as good as what it used to be. And I think that's going to hurt them as the year goes on, and especially in the playoffs. And so that's why I elevated Minnesota ahead of them.
And it wasn't a great bench to begin with, you know.
Average.
Yeah, average. At best, on a good day. So, Carter, what do you think?
For me, I do it based off of how much I would be scared for the Liberty to play them between the two.
Yeah.
And I think when I watched the game yesterday, I think it said the Liberty have won like six of the last seven meetings or seven of the last eight meetings between the two.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas them in Minnesota go back and forth and back and forth. I'm more uncertain about the Liberty's ability to beat Minnesota than I am for them to beat the Aces.
Yeah.
So that's how I gauge it.
Yeah. Makes sense. We were watching the games the other night, and I kept telling Carter, I just love watching Nafisa Collier play basketball. She is just so good. Reading screen, she's a great screener. I think that's, you know, how is she open all the time? Because she's a great screener, you know. And I think they have really good chemistry. It's 1A, 1B to me. I think those two and New York are the three best teams. I think Indiana is, in my opinion, they're the fourth best team, but I think they're a tier below. Now they're closing ground, and obviously if Caitlin Clark were to continue to play like this, that's going to make it a heck of a lot more competitive. But I just felt like Las Vegas had a little bit more. You know, Becky Hammon at the end of the year last year, she referred to, she didn't come out and say it, but I think she referred to some chemistry issues, and we've got to get the focus back to players who just want to play basketball instead of doing other things. And the one player that was removed from that core was Kelsey Plum. So was there some stuff going on in the locker room that nobody talked about? I mean, we'll never know. Or I don't say we'll never know, but we don't know as of right now. So we'll see how Jewel Lloyd fits in with that crew. But Asia Wilson is just so good. She was beat up at the end of the year last year. And I think kind of this unrivaled league is perhaps going to help a lot of these high-end players with their stamina and their physical shape, not being beat up, having to travel halfway across the world to play their other half of their season in Turkey or Russia or something like that, by staying in the States and not taxing their bodies as much. Let's see how much that might help the Asia Wilsons, the Chelsea Grays, those type of players at the end of the year as well. But I think it's going to be, regardless, are we in agreement that it's going to be a heck of a race between Minnesota and Las Vegas?
Mm-hmm.
And I agree with Collier. I think she, along with Asia Wilson, Brianna Stewart, and Caitlin Clark, I think one of those four is going to be the MVP. And my money might be on Collier.
All right. Tony, who's your prediction to take it all in the W?
I'm going to roll with the Lynx.
Carter Plum?
Yeah, their heart broke last year, but I would pay a lot of money to watch them and the Liberty again. I thought that was a great, great series last year.
It was. It was really good. Carter?
New York Liberty.
Is that a homer vote, or is that what your mind is telling you?
I think they genuinely have. I mean, we saw in their opener, season opener, Natasha Cloud was a great addition to their already super power team.
Mm-hmm.
And she's almost like Benaja Laimi Hamilton, but better.
Mm-hmm.
And that with Maureen Johannes coming back, Leonie Fibish is now back with the team working with them. I mean, they made good better.
Yeah.
And I don't think any other team in the WNBA has gotten extremely better
uh-huh.
or
even maybe a little better that was at the top. I don't think the Lynx got any better from my point of view besides Jessica Shepherd.
Yeah. Their cohesion looked good the other night, especially for the first night out. I think the one team that has made big moves and is poised to make a big jump is Indiana. I Clark's going to be better her second year. Aaliyah Boss is coming into her own. Kelsey Mitchell, DeWanna Bonner is a perfect fit as a role player, as a veteran. I hate to say the third leading scorer in league history is a role player, but you know I think she's just going to be a great fit. So it's going to be a heck of a race. I'm gonna be the fly in the ointment here. I'm gonna say Las Vegas. So Tony's got Minnesota, Carter's got New York, I've got Las Vegas. Let's see how it plays out here, gentlemen. How's that sound?
Okie dokie.
Sounds like a good plan.
All right. Episode 131 in the books. Tony, anything else on one-on-one basketball, the importance of one-on-one, playing it on both sides of the ball?
It may seem a little clunky at first, but playing one-on-one, when you get to where you want to get to in the postseason, it will pay its dividends.
Yep. I agree. You're going to have to create something out of nothing. You're going to have to teach your players how to do it. It's just like anything else. You think in November and December and January, you're supposed to be worried about the team. But part of worrying about the team is making sure that you can create plays when the coach can't control everything. And I think that's a big part of it. So great stuff here this week. Tony, hopefully neither one of us gets hit by any weather or anything like that. Hopefully we both say it's raining right now in Omaha. So hopefully we just stay with rain here the next couple of days. So Carter, thanks so much for coming on again. Did you enjoy it?
Yeah, it's fun.
Good. Good. Check out all the stuff that we have available with a pen and a napkin. Looking forward to just a lot of really good things here. We are 2 weeks away from our special guest. No offense, Carter, but we've got another special guest coming that Tony's really, really excited. Not to say that he's not. Tony, you were excited to have Tony on, or to have Carter on, but you could say that.
Yes, I thought Carter added a lot, did a good job with his WNBA knowledge. I was impressed.
Yeah, so, we're excited for that. We got a lot of great things going here. We're going over an hour already here. So, coaches, as always, let's be sure to hone our craft one day at a time.